Good evening, one and all. Yes, another week already, partway through November. I can't keep up with it. It's going so quick, I tell you. And here we are with another book and a chat. Well, I'm here and my guest is here, and we were just chatting beforehand because I'm fighting a cold at the moment. You know, when you sort of the eyes start going and you start sneezing and you start, oh, here we go, coughing and that. Well, I'm fighting it, so I'm sucking on throat pastilles. I've got my tea here, I've got some water here and everything. And anyway, I was just talking to my guests about how the weather, I mean, we, one day it's like 70s, 80s, next day it's down 30s, 40s. We can't keep up with it. But one of the things I just found out is my guest today, she's a neighbour, a couple of towns up the road, not far away at all. What can I say about her? Well, she's started in as a reporter, went through like communication stuff, but since then she's written not one but two really good sort of well, biographies, I guess, for want of a better word. Anyway, we better find out, haven't I? I better introduce her. Because on the show today, I have the one and only Judy L. Mandel. Hi, Judy. How are you doing?
I'm doing fine. Thank you for having me on.
It's a pleasure. You could have come down here.
I know. You're right down the street.
Yeah, right. One of the things we always sort of say is, on the show, were you sort of jotting down stories as soon as you could hold a crayon? But, in your case, you've been in communications right the way through your working life. So were you one of these kids that were jotting little things, from a very young age?
I did. I think poetry was the first thing I wrote when I was a kid. And I'm not saying that it was any good, but I did dabble in that. And I was always reading and writing. So, it just seemed to follow me.
Yeah,
for
it's,
sure.
It's like, I would say, it's like there's a creative gene, whether it's communications, whether it's words, whether it's painting, whether it's art, whether it's sculpture, whatever. There is a gene that just makes you one of these people that can communicate. People know the whole reason I started these shows was when my books came out, I was sort of on a few shows, and some of the hosts were terrible. I was having to lead them, and it's the equivalent of watching paint dry, but on a chat show, if you know what I mean. And I thought, well, I enjoy a good chat. I'll have a go at this. And there was another lady in my sort of writing group said she wanted to have a go, so she was a guest on my show, and I was a guest on her show, and that was about 14 years ago. And since that time, the second book in the series has been stuck halfway through, and I've done coming up to 1,700 shows. So I think my communications has definitely moved from written word to word of mouth sort of thing. I should have said, of course, you're award-winning artist, author, because indeed that's what you are. Your book, 2013, was it? The Replacement Child, award-winning.
Yeah, thank you. Yes, it was a New York Times bestseller. I'm very proud to say.
And this was a biography, but didn't it sort of stem from essays or something like that?
It was really a memoir about
memoir.
My family.
Why did I say biography? I meant memoir. Sorry.
That's okay. No problem. Yeah, I think it's a confusing, term for some people, that it's, one piece of your life.
Yeah.
And this was, Replacement Child was more focused on my family that came through a plane crash where one sister was killed and the other sister was badly injured. And the thread through that book to White Flag, my new book, is that my sister, who was badly injured, is the mother of Cheryl, who's featured in this new book.
Do you find it, the fact that they're memoirs, do you find it more like almost like you're reporting on something? And with your reporter background, does that sort of come more easier than perhaps writing a fictional type book?
For me, it does. I know it's different for everybody, but it seems like I can only write things that are, although I have dabbled in fiction, but memoir comes more easily to me, and maybe it is the reporter background, you're right. you know, that I kind of gather evidence and then I tried to put together the pieces of how they fit together.
I wondered about that, really, the evidence stuff, because I think I read that it sort of grew from early essays. So was that like the evidence that you sort of had those essays and then molded them into, you know, into the novel?
Well, with White Flag, the evidence was really were letters from my niece, journal entries from my niece, and pieces of research that I did, in this case, about substance use disorder. So those were kind of the tentacles of, you know, reaching for the evidence in this case.
Well, as you said, you know, the first book, Replacement Child, New York Times bestseller, and it is about a family, people, you know, child in a plane crash and stuff like that. But as you just told us, the from that book is your new book, came out a couple of months back, only that's all, isn't it? September, something like that, called White Flag. And this is about, you know, one of your family and what happened to her.
Yeah, it's really a deep dive into substance use disorder. You know, why people use substances, why they can't stop, why some people can stop and others can't. And I did a lot of research into the complexities of that.
Right, because Cheryl, you know, your niece sort of thing, you thought she died. You know, she might have been dead. And it's only like two years or something, suddenly find that she's actually in jail.
Yes, that was the case. I didn't know where she was for a couple of years, which I think other people have had that experience that have loved ones with substance use disorder, that they disappear for a period of time or, you know, they can't find them. And that was the case here. And I was able to find her. I was very relieved to find that she was still alive, although she was in prison. But that seemed to be secondary. The relief that I felt that she was just alive was enormous.
Yeah, I mean, it must have been horrendous, especially, you know, following the loss of, you know, from the plane crash, etc., to now have this niece you think might be dead. You did, you know, had she sorted herself out? Had anything happened to her? And then find, no, she's actually in jail because of the drugs and because of, you know, how this had changed her, I guess, as well. It must have done it in that time.
And, you know, a lot of people will wind up in jail or prison, you know, because it's sort of a side effect of substance use disorder and the crime that happens to accompany it and has almost nothing to do with the substance use. But that's, you know, that's what happens. What happens.
Well, in your case, I'm guessing that White Flag, as it's called, you know, doesn't actually start with Cheryl with this issue. It actually most likely goes back to what happened in The Replacement Child. Is that right?
Well, what I found when I was researching and trying to figure out what the hell happened was that transgenerational trauma is a real thing. That things that have happened even before your birth follow your family and follow you and make you who you are. And that was really an eye-opening piece of research that I found.
Yeah, because people have, in a lot of cases, for whatever reason, people, you know, things happen to people. No idea why this happens, why one goes this way, why one goes that way. And also, you know, in this case as well, you know, you hear that people, you know, can get through addiction or shake addiction off. Other people can't. They're stuck with it. Did you sort of come across that sort of thing as well?
Well, that was a big question I had. You know, why can some people, you know, take a drink and, you know, go on their way, and another person will tell me if they take a drink in a bar, they'll be closing the bar. And it's a combination of, it's not a simple answer. There's not really a gene from what I found, mm-hmm. but it may be the way that hormones work on genes. And it may be carried through from some trauma, from generational trauma, or in their immediate life trauma. It may be that there's another underlying reason. There may be depression. There may be other
right,
mental
right.
Illness as well.
And people don't see that, of course. This is the thing. You know, it's you have obviously now you've gone into it. You know, you've come across that sort of thing. But some people say, oh, you know, those people, you know, they whatever happened, they've been in drugs. That's it, sort of thing. They don't know. They don't realise that it could be linked to other things. It could even be, and you used the word tentacles, which I think is a great way to describe it, from the trauma of you know, what happened in Replacement Child.
Mm-hmm. That's part of it. And there's also, you know, there's also brain chemistry that changes with substance use. And the younger a person starts, the more difficult it is to change that, to reverse that. And so brain chemistry is a huge part of why some people can stop and why some people can't.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, you come across that all the time, and people just, it's something people don't read, or you don't perhaps know, but who's to say what can do it? And like you've obviously now found out that, you know, these things we don't know, for want of a better.
And I want to amend that a little bit. You know, when I say they can't, it what I mean to say is that it's harder.
Harder, and, yeah, right.
You know, because I do believe that they can change and they can get better, but knowing, you know, where the issues are is the first challenge.
So you called it white flag. Was there a reason behind that?
You know, there were several reasons why I called it white flag. At first, I called it white flag because that's the way I found a bed for my niece when she was homeless, was that the shelters would wave, they wouldn't wave their white flag now, but they would have a white flag event, they call it now, when the weather gets so inclement that in order to save people's lives, they opened up their doors, whether they had beds or not. And it was a very, very cold winter in Louisville, Kentucky. And that's when she was homeless, and we finally did find her bed in a white flag event. The other piece of white flag, because it, you know, is traditionally surrender, is that people with substance use disorder, I believe, need to surrender to the fact that they need help. And that's the very difficult piece of it. The third part of it was for myself was that I needed to surrender to what I could and couldn't do.
Yeah, it must be very hard in, you know, for somebody like yourself to want to do stuff and come to grips with the fact that you just can't do some things. It's not, you know, no matter how hard you try, it's not just you that needs to do it. And that must be, I'm guessing, one of the hardest things to sort of actually come to grips with that and realize that, you know, that you can't wave a magic wand and suddenly everything's okay.
That's right. Yeah. And, you know, I always try to fix things. That's, you know, kind of my mode of operating. So,
well, I think we all do. I mean, I think, you know, no matter what it is, if especially family, you know, we want to, if we can, heal things, make things better, you know, be the person who.
Right.
And sometimes in doing it, you can make it worse even. Let alone, affect you. And suddenly you find yourself spiraling down.
And since, you know, this is not, it did not have a happy ending. My niece did pass away from an overdose.
Oh, sorry.
And so, you know, wondering about what I could and couldn't do, you know, followed me into the grief of her passing, which I think many people would relate to with anybody in their family who's passed. You know, you always question what
could you have done anything. Yeah, indeed. You said, you know, people sort of, you know, reading it could do, you know, could take that from it. What sort of response have you had to White Flag?
You know, deep discussions. It's been really very, very good discussions when I go in person to talk to people, and even, you know, interviews like yourself. You know, most people have some relationship to this, either themselves or family member, or they know someone. It almost touches everyone, and they all have really the same questions. What happened? Why couldn't they stop? Why couldn't I help them? And in the case of people who have passed away, you know, why couldn't I save them? And those are the questions I tried to answer with this book. And I don't, you know, I don't purport to have all the answers in this, but I think that it gets people thinking. I hope it gets people thinking differently about it.
And that's a big thing. That's a big thing, because if you're going from Replacement Child into White Flag and all that happened between there, then there are people that have been affected in various ways that can relate to one or the other. But when it comes down to it, in the end, it's living with it. And mm-hmm. you accepting, you know, as you said, people thinking, what could I have done? What could I have done different? How could I have helped this more? You know, should I have done this? And people make themselves ill themselves, you know, because of this. It can affect their whole life. I know in my own family, you know, my ex-wife, actually, her son died of cancer at like 22, something like that. She thought he thought he was in remission. He thought he was in remission. Mm. He died whilst driving, died at the wheel. You know, she will never get over, this is like 7-8 years ago now, she will never get over the fact that, you know, he died before she has. And you know, there's not a day goes by she doesn't blame herself for something, or she should have checked up on him more, or, you know, this, that and the other. And no matter what you say, you can't. They're never going to. I'm never going to sort of change her. She's never going to change anything.
No, I think I learned. I learned that losing a child is something that you don't get over. My mother would tell me that because she lost her daughter in that plane crash, and I think for her whole life she questioned what she did, and she had to make decisions. She had to save one daughter, and she had to leave the other daughter behind.
I mean, that's even harder. I mean, that's, you know, when you have to do that. I was watching something the other day where somebody's. Some father was out with his two children, and they got swept overboard by, you know, in bad weather or something, you know, sailing, and he could only save one. Who'd you save? Yeah, I mean, and then the rest of your life, you're sort of saying, did it right? Yeah, especially perhaps if the one that you saved turns out perhaps not to be that brilliant, you know, or you've got some issues, sort of thing. but it's hard.
Well, that's a whole other story.
Of course it is. But right. we are not made to just accept something like that. We be it conscious or what have you. Yeah,
And I always say, you know, there are things that you don't get over. It just changes your reality. And I think that's the way it is with all grief, really. It's not something that you can, in many cases, you don't get over it. Mm. It just changes you. And you have a new reality.
Right. Yeah, that's why I said it. I think it's the acceptance.
Yeah.
You're not going to get over it. Yeah. But the acceptance makes you have that new level of reality, whatever. Well, that's what I believe anyway.
And writing this book and getting more of an understanding of really what I was up against that I had no idea at the time. It has, you know, given me that kind of relief of that kind of regret and guilt, although that doesn't really go away, as I said.
Right.
But understanding more helps. Does help.
When you were writing it, did you sort of come across things that you'd actually basically locked away and didn't want to know about, but in writing it, like the Pandora's box was opened and you suddenly realized stuff and you were able to accept stuff?
Sure. I mean, one of the things was realizing the silence that was in my family for my whole life, you know, and I do think that silence in a family is a trauma of its own kind, you know, that not talking about.
Oh, not talking. Yeah.
Certainly
we don't
trauma.
Mention so and yeah. so. Yeah. Oh, crikey. Yes.
Right. Or, you know, Cheryl's mother was badly burned in that accident, that plane crash. Mm-hmm. We never talked about that. We never talked about, you know, the social issues she was having or even the real pains that she had from, you know, surgery and everything she went through. we never talked about that. We never talked about how hard it was for her to fit in, or maybe, you know, that a therapist might be helpful. And with Cheryl, my sister didn't tell me a lot of things that were going on with Cheryl. And another instance of silence.
Do you think that that's people are worried about the stigma or embarrassed to bring that sort of thing out? Why do you think?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, even just the word addiction and addict and relapse, all of those words have a stigma to them, and people don't want to talk about it. And if there's a prison, if prison's involved, there's another stigma.
But if you go back like 20 years, you could say the same thing about being gay. And yet now it's become so commonplace and accepted, and it's nothing in most families, shall I say, these days. There are still families that we don't talk about that one, or you know, because they're gay and something like that. But I know that my kids at school and everything, when they were at school, everything was so open, with gay relationships.
It's much more accepted, which is a great thing.
Yeah, which is good because...
You're right. And things change.
Yeah.
Things change.
Well, yeah, it could
and
be
that's,
that you that's
know, that's my hope, too.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's actually why I try to use the words, substance use disorder instead of addiction.
Oh,
because
right.
I feel like it does relieve some of that stigma and shame, and people can talk about it the way they talk about someone having diabetes.
Yes.
That they have... Yeah. They have a medical issue that needs to be tended to, needs to be treated.
Now, but diabetes, people didn't talk about diabetes 25, 30 years ago. You know, it was, somebody's got to hide in the cupboard to inject themselves, or something like that. I mean, it's just hopefully, it's a sign that in the future, we might be able to accept that this is an illness, it's people looking for help or something like that, rather than make such a stigma of it all.
And I think that's true too. And that's one of the reasons that I, I'm trying to talk to people about it. I did write this as a memoir, and it's certainly my personal story and my niece's personal story, but it's also a universal story of what people go through to try to help somebody when they don't really know what they're dealing with.
And I think that was certainly
the case,
Exactly. And I think that's why, both books, I'm sure are helping or have helped or will help a lot of people, because people perhaps don't realize what's going on. Whereas you've gone through it, been able to share with these people, and people might suddenly, oh crikey, I never thought of that. I didn't realize that could be. And thinking back on it, that could well be the case, and I should have perhaps helped this, and perhaps this is how I can help somebody a bit more, sort of thing. I'm sure talking to you, that's sort of one of the aims of the books, anyway.
Absolutely is. You're absolutely right. And I'm certainly not the first one to talk about this way, but I'm hoping that I reach people in a different way, and they get a different perspective from this story.
I'm sure they will. It's a great pleasure chatting to you about this, really is, and it's great when we're able to sort of share such things on the program. But time is running away with us, so what I'm going to do now is hand the show over to you, so you can tell everybody where people can find more about you and your books.
Sure, thank you very much for that. They can go to my website, which is judymandel.com. That's my name, Judy Mandel. My book is available on Amazon. It's available at local bookstores, anywhere you buy books. And it's called White Flag. And it just came out in October.
Okay. Well, great. Well, good luck with the books. Are you started on anything else at the moment?
I'm writing some essays and writing some shorter pieces, because books take a long time.
I know. I always tell people, I used to do... My main YA book, I did it when we used to have lunch hours, long, long time ago
at
work, at work, and Nowadays you don't. You have sort of 2 minutes to grab a sandwich. That's it. But yeah, we used to have lunch hours at work, and so when I sort of had, if I'd eaten with the rest of the sort of lunch hour, I sort of did a chapter, every other day, sort of thing.
I remember. Yeah. I remember that. Yeah.
That's how I did my
That's
book.
So funny.
Anyway, good luck, and thank you so much for being a guest on the show.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure.
My pleasure. Well, there you go. My guest today, Judy L. Mandel. And as she says, her website, J-U-D-Y, Judy, and then M-A-N-D-E-L, Mandel. Forget the L for the website. It's Judy Mandel. And talking about her two books. And the very first one, we've been talking about Replacement Child. Very interesting book. And in fact, they both are. And I'm sure make people not just think, but also hopefully, well, I'm sure help people. The new one came out September. And that is called White Flag. Look out for them. Very interesting and very helpful books. Well, I'll be back tomorrow, Wednesday, 7 p.m. Eastern tomorrow, 6:30 on a Tuesday, 7 on a Wednesday, with a fresh guest. And till then, though, we have one thing left to say. Don't forget.